knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men. The shadow knows.
Ladies and gentlemen, to stay at the top and meet the competition of the underworld's keenest minds, the Shadow has to be still better than any of them. And it's the same way with tires.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
10, 9, 8, 7, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition, 2, 1, 0, we have a liftoff. We have a liftoff and it's lighting up the areas. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center as the Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Hello and welcome to White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Books in association with the Earth Station One Network. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. I'm Van Allen Plexico. Today's topic is pulp, new pulp, and the work of Barry Reese. And here to discuss it with me, what a shock, is Barry Reese. Welcome aboard the show, Barry.
Thank you very much, Van. It's an honor to be here.
Well, let me tell the folks a little bit about you. In 2003, Barry began working for Marvel Comics on Volume 5 of their Marvel Encyclopedia series, an awesome project. Then his first novel was Conquerors of Shadow, The Adventures of Eobard Grace in 2005, featuring a setting and character inspired by the work of Edgar Rice Burroughs. Then came Lucifer's Cage and Kingdom of Blood, set in the 1930s with a masked vigilante dubbed The Rook, and he was inspired by the pulp magazine heroes of the past. And The Rook is something we're really going to, I think, talk about a good bit here as we go along. I'm looking forward to. Wildcat Books published 5 volumes of The Rook before the series moved to Pro Se Productions in 2011 and continues on. He's also written stories for several anthologies published by Wildcat Books, including characters like Guan Yin, which is, I believe, your own pirate character, yes, and also Kygor, the Jungle Lord. And in January 2010, Wildcat Books released Rabbit Heart, a slasher horror novel with pulp underpinnings, and it was Barry's first mature readers-only book, and set entirely in Milledgeville, Georgia, which is Barry's hometown.
Yes.
In March of 2010, Barry's short story, Sins of the Past, was published in How the West Was Weird from Pulpwork Press. And then later, he had The Sacred and the Profane in Mystery Men and Women, Volume 1 from Airship 27. He also began writing Lazarus Gray for Pro Se in that time, which is another one of his sort of famous ongoing characters. The Damned Thing was published in January 2011, a great title. The 2011 Pulp Arc Award saw Barry designated as, he was nominated for Best Book, Rabbit Heart, Best Author, Best Short Story, The Girl with the Phantom Eyes, the first Lazarus Gray story, and Best Pulp Revival. And on March 1st, it was announced that he had been voted Best Author, and congratulations for that. In, September 2011, Barry was included in the Green Hornet Case Files and the Avenger Justice Incorporated Files book from Moonstone, and the first volume of Lazarus Gray series was published from Pro Se. In 2012, Barry got Best Short Story in the Pulp Arc Awards and was nominated for Georgia Author of the Year. He had work published in Tales of the Rook, The New Adventures of Richard Knight, and The New Adventures of Thunder Jim Wade early that year. And 2013 saw Barry win Best Novel in the Pulp Arc Awards and receive his third Georgia Author of the Year nomination and another Avengers story and the first Gravedigger series. So, Barry, why aren't you doing more work? I don't understand.
Well, it's funny. You're reading all that. I was getting tired just listening to it. I was like, man, I'm really busy. Mm.
And you don't seem to be getting any recognition for it either. Grief, man. Lord.
Well, you know, I've always been prolific, and you know, I'm a very fast typist. I type about 120 words a minute, and unfortunately, I still don't type as fast as my brain works.
Right.
And so I think that's a key, and I write every day. So.
Yeah, I that's one of my secrets too, is typing, is being able to type very fast and get it down right usually the first time. Would you say you're the kind of a writer that can pretty much get down what you're trying to get down the first time, or do you have to do a lot of rewrites?
No, pretty much my first draft in terms of story is almost exactly what you're going to get at the end. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, you know, with everybody, there's going to be some typos here and there, and little, you know, sometimes you think you typed that word, but you were going so fast you didn't do it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's a lot of copy editing afterwards, but in terms of the story and the plot, I usually get that right off the bat and don't have to rework it.
Yeah, I think that there's a whole lot of things like that that all add up to how much somebody can turn out. I think it's having a lot of good ideas, having a lot of ideas and then having them be good. I think it's how fast you can work. I think it's being able to work on it every day certainly helps. And also, I think that being able to kind of get your get what's in your brain down on the screen and on the paper more or less, like you say, the first time, that all figures into it. You know, it's like going on a long trip. And each little stop doesn't seem like much, but if you stop a whole bunch of times, you never seem to get to your destination. And so being able to kind of keep the car going, keep it on the highway, that really does seem to be the key to getting a lot done.
Oh, yeah. I tell people all the time, you know, even if you only write 500 words a day, which is not much, that adds up over the course of a month. And, you know, so just try and get something down there every day. There are days I only get 200 words written, and then there are days I get 3,000 words written.
Right.
And it just all adds up.
Yeah, I'm much more of a momentum writer. I, you know, when I'm working on something, I know, when I know exactly what I'm going to do, I know exactly what's coming next, and I have it all kind of laid out, then I can really go, which is one of the reasons why I'm sort of infamous as being kind of a big plotter, because I like to know my roadmap. I don't like to drive in uncharted territory. It slows me down, and it provides a disincentive to sit down at the keyboard. And so, yeah, knowing where I'm going and what I'm going to do makes a huge difference, and I can actually go days and days. In fact, you know, I have to say, there's with a couple of exceptions, and part of the reason why has been getting this football book out, but it's been January. We're recording this May 30th, and it's been January since I did any serious prose writing. So all these people that talk about how prolific I am will be shocked to learn that, but it just you know, circumstances have led to that. So it's a very nice thing to be able to work every day, and I'm terribly envious. Now, before we get further into your stuff, let's sort of look at the historical background of all this. You and I both, to some degree, work in this sort of pulp, new pulp world. The generally the first question, so I've already blown that, but generally the first question that I ask somebody on here is sort of how you came to it. So give us sort of the background of how you came to this sort of material originally.
You know, I grew up with it. My parents were divorced when I was very, very young. And, you know, my birth father, when he would get me on the weekends, one of the things that we would do, we would stay up late on Friday and Saturday nights, way later than my mother would have liked, and watch terrible, terrible horror movies. I mean, old, you know, classics like, you know, Creature from the Black Lagoon, but then also just terrible B movies. And so I've always loved those. And he had tons of pulp novel reprints lying around. This was back when Doc Savage was being reprinted in the Bantam series and with his James Balma covers. And, you know, he had all the Conan stuff and John Carter and the Avenger, all of that kind of stuff. And I was really taken with those covers. And even before I could read an entire novel, I would, like, you know, take them to school with me. I'd have, like, a, you know, a Doc Savage, you know, stuck in my back pocket or something. And, you know, when I was a kid, I was really a huge Robert E. Howard fan with Conan and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, each one of those little Ace reprints had a little biography of him in the front that talked about his life and his writing and his, you know, communications with other authors and stuff. And I just read those things so many times that I just memorized them. I could tell you every facet of his life.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really what fostered in me not only a love of the pulp genre and characters, but also of wanting to be a writer. I wanted to do those kind of things. And so even when I was a little kid, I was making up my own stories. And of course, the pulps, you know, were always linked with comic books for me, because my father had a lot of those as well. And they had kind of similar themes. They had larger-than-life heroes and truly evil villains and just frenetic action. And so I grew up with pulp. And, you know, when I got into my teenage years, by that time there wasn't as much pulp being reprinted, and there seemed to be a lot less overtly pulp characters out there. I mean, you had Indiana Jones and you had things like that. But, you know, there was a long period there where, as a pulp fan, you know, before internet came along, I thought that this was all stuff that was being forgotten. And, you know, thankfully, once I got onto the internet and I, you know, spent a few years hanging out with all my comic book fan friends, I discovered that there are a lot of pulp fans out there as well. And then I discovered that there are people not actually just reprinting the old stuff, but actually writing new pulp stories. Mm-hmm. And the first one I read was by Ron Fortier, and it was The Hounds of Hell. And it was a great book that featured Dr. Satan in battle against the Moon Man. And at that time, I'd never heard of the Moon Man. Dr. Satan I was familiar with by name. But I ordered that book and I read it in like 2 days, and I was like, man, this is the kind of stuff I read when I was a kid. And I was just so thrilled to see that there was still the possibility of writing new stories like that, that I immediately then ran out and attempted to get in contact with Ron Hanna, who was listed as the publisher of that book. And that's kind of how I ended up in the new pulp world. But you know, I mean, I grew up loving pulp, and the chance to write a character like the Avenger, who, along with the Shadow, is probably my favorite pulp hero, and to have the chance to actually write two stories, to actually be Kenneth Robinson, you know, twice, which is the suit of the, you know, the house name they used for that series. I mean, it's just amazing. It really is a dream come true.
Right. Yeah. No, that's fairly similar in some ways to my own experience. I know what you mean. And yeah, I think for me, it was discovering this new form of publishing and that was going on, like you say, and realizing that it was probably closer to what I already did. I mean, you know, I had been writing sort of serious, long form science fiction novels, or trying to, on and off for years. And I knew that really, that's what I wanted to do, but I knew it wasn't working for me. I wanted to have more fun with it. I wanted there to be more action, to be more adventure, to be fun, you know, to not be something that's kind of, you feel like it's a duty. Oh, I have to read this big towering tome here. No, I wanted something that would pull me in the way that the Amber books did, you know, when I was a kid or something, where I just couldn't put it down. I'd stay up till 3 o'clock in the morning reading until I fell asleep reading it. And so that's the way I always tried to write. And so, yeah, it was a real revelation to find out that that's kind of a viable format, you know, I guess you'd call it a format, right, or style or whatever, and that it was making a comeback. And so you and I both have been very, I think, fortunate to kind of get in on the ground floor of helping to build this new thing. And that's a big part of what I want to talk about as we go forward here. So so Robert E. Howard, Conan stuff, and Doc Savage. What other kind of things peripheral to that were you into early on that have kind of shaped the way that you write and create things?
Well, of course, you know, I mean, I grew up on comic books. So, I mean, people like Marv Wolfman and Len Wein, Chris Claremont, Jim Starlin, Mike Grell, Paul Levitz. I mean, all of those guys, Mike W. Barr. I mean, everybody who was pretty much big in the 70s and the 80s. I think, you know, kind of seeped into my consciousness. I think a lot of, even though I write pulp, my stories tend to be continued stories and they have subplots that run through them. And sometimes I'll have multiple subplots over the course of different books. And that's all, I think, directly attributable, or, you know, you can put the blame on it if you want, to Chris Claremont's writing style, which was, you know, a huge impact on me when I was growing up. you know, I mean, I read so much stuff as a kid. I mean, Michael Moorcock's Eternal Champion stuff really had themes that I've always been interested in and played with. You know, the Sherlock Holmes stuff, even though you don't really, I don't think you overtly see much of the Arthur Conan Doyle influence in my writing. I think just the way that he was able to do characterization almost on the run, because most of the Sherlock Holmes stories, you know, they're very plot centric, they're very plot heavy. But over the course of that short story, there's nevertheless at least three or four scenes in each one that are really character definition building scenes with Holmes and Watson. And that's what I've tried to incorporate in my own work as well. The ability to do characterization while things are happening. And, you know, and when it comes to other pulp writers, I mean, obviously, Walter Gibson, his work on The Shadow is a huge impact on me. And Paul Ernst, who not only wrote those Avenger books, but also did Dr. Satan and did an incredible character called CK, which is very obscure. His work is a huge impact on me as well. So, I mean, I guess those are my major influences.
Did you originally want to write comics, or have you always been more of a prose guy and that was always what you were happy with?
When I was a very young guy, I wanted to write prose. And then as I got a little older, got into high school and into college, I decided I wanted to be a comic book writer. And so through my college years, I mean, I submitted stuff to Slave Labor and Dark Horse and Caliber and a whole bunch of other people, and received this huge stack of rejection letters. And one thing that whole experience really taught me was that I don't enjoy comic book scripting at all. There's an artificiality to the scripting process that disrupts my storytelling. When I'm in prose, I mean, I have control over the direction and the story and how I describe the characters and what they're thinking and all of that. And I feel like I have a good grasp of it. But when I'm converting that to script, and I'm having to go panel by panel, dialogue bubble by dialogue bubble, that to me disrupts my natural flow. And so, you know, after I'd gotten a whole stack of these rejection letters, I was like, you know what? I don't want to do comic book stuff. And at that point, actually, you know, I had graduated from college and I had gotten a job and I was, you know, getting married and all that. And I just decided, you know what? This is not going to be my career, writing. And so I was still writing a little bit just for fun, but I was not sending it to publishers. And when I got onto the internet and I stumbled across fan fiction, like Marvel Volume 1.
I've heard of it. Nature,
yes. I discovered, hey, there's other people out there who like this kind of stuff. And so I started writing stories, you know, there. And I know there are some writers who look down on fan fiction, but I think it's great for getting immediate feedback.
Yes.
I think it's great for learning what things you do well and what things you do not. I think it can teach you a lot about writing for an audience.
It's a laboratory.
Exactly. Because you get to see what things connect with other people and how to connect with them. And, you know, it also teaches you, I think, a lot about building your own characters, because one great thing about fan fiction is you're generally working, obviously, with other people's characters. And so you're taking them and you've already got this base to build from. You've already got this history and this continuity. And I think if you do it well and you do it right, you can learn from that about how to add those kind of details to your own characters.
That's an excellent point. Let me follow up on real quick where you say, because, you know, I think when somebody's first learning how to write and to really tell a story, to engage a reader, engage an audience, it can be a little daunting perhaps to have to try to learn all these things at once. Yes. And so you make a very good point there that one of the things that fan fiction provides is that part of the house is already built. You only have to do the roof, or you only have to put the doors on or something, right? Because you've already had some of that work done for you. Now, it's not the ideal thing for making your own career necessarily, but it certainly can be a good, the equivalent of like a primary school you know, mm-hmm. learning the basics before you go out and start doing your trade. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think there definitely has to come a point where you kind of move away from that and start doing your own things. But yeah, I mean, I think it's a very strong foundation to build upon.
Yeah.
And so after doing that for a few years, and, you know, I ended up at Marvel, and, you know, even when I was doing stuff at Marvel, and that was great. It was an incredibly fun thing to get a check, you know, with Spider-Man printed on it from Marvel Entertainment, and to be in contact with people, and to contact, you know, Kurt Busiek and say, you know, I've got a question about this, and, you know, I'm working on this, and have him answer it, and things like that. But I always tell people the most fun part of working for Marvel was telling people that I was working for Marvel, because the work itself was not that thrilling nor that creative, what I was doing anyway. And so I really did want to do other things, because even though I had worked on their official handbook series and their encyclopedia, you know, I couldn't escape that when I would show that work to like family members and friends, that there was always that undercurrent. You could sense that it wasn't like a real book. It wasn't like real writing. Mm. And, you know, I wanted to do that. I wanted to write a real book. And so that's when I decided to dive back into prose and fiction again. And so a very long way of getting to the point was I started out in prose, moved into comics, and then came back to prose.
Yeah. And when you talk about script in comics, I think, it really is. I don't think that maybe people realize just how different the functions, the process is of of going from scripting to prose. And, you know, the metaphor that comes to my mind, I had this in the car a while ago. Let me get back in the car here and expand my metaphor, torture it a little bit, which is that to me, prose, writing a novel, writing a short story, a novella, to me, that's, you've got your feet on the gas and the brakes, you got your hand on the wheel, you know, you're on the highway.
Right.
Scripting to me is you're in the back seat, if not the trunk, and you're occasionally going, now turn right and try to make it like a 90 degree angle when you turn. Okay. And then, if there's any way in the next couple of minutes that you can go, you know, 40 miles an hour, do that. But if that won't work, try, you know, to me, it's so indirect. You know, you're having to work through multiple layers of interface, being the artist, the editor, you know, whatever else, that it's extremely frustrating and limiting to me. I just had my first script published in the All-Star Pulp Comics number 2, A Gideon Kane Story. But, you know, number one, it's extremely challenging. And number two, the shorter the script, to me, the harder it is.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And, you know, people who can do both prose and comic scripting and both do them so well, I'm very, very much amazed by. Sure. I wish I could do that. A lot of people, and I'm sure you get it more than I do with your Sentinel stuff, but a lot of times people will say, oh, you need to do a Rook comic or a Lazarus Gray comic. And
right.
I'm like, you know, God, I'd hate it.
Yeah, right.
I mean, I would love to have it out there. I would love to have a Lazarus Gray comic. I would just hate to be the one doing it.
Yeah. So. Yeah, exactly. I always say the question I get the most probably is there a Sentinels comic book or will there be one? And I always say, you know, yeah, I think you're exactly right. The answer I don't give is I wouldn't want to do it because I don't have to tell them that. But yeah, I think you're exactly right that, and it would, I always say it would take away what's special because there's a million superheroes and superhero team comics. How many, you know, great long series of novels are there? And think how many comics I'd have had to write by now to get to the same point in the story. So. Yeah, scripting is a whole other animal, and I agree with you that being able to do both, it really is. You would have had to put a lot of effort into both worlds to get that good. I think at both. I was going to ask you about this, and this came to my mind a little while ago when you were talking about early days wanting to be a writer. I consider myself very fortunate that from the earliest days, I was reading Starlog magazine.
Mm-hmm. And, Street Starlog.
Yeah. And one of the things that it had was a every issue column by David Gerald. You know, David Gerald is the writer who wrote the famous Trouble with Tribbles. He'll, you know, on his tombstone, it'll say David Gerald wrote Trouble with Tribbles. Right. But he's written a lot of other stuff too. And you know, one of the first columns I read by him, and this just is one of those fortuitous moments of timing, is that one of the first columns I read by him, as I was first thinking about the idea of writing, I was probably like, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old, was he said that he gets letters and stuff, he would back then, from people saying they want to be a writer, or people come up to him at a convention or something and say, I want to be a writer. And he would say that I'm always suspicious of that, because do you want to be a writer or do you want to write? You know, he says, if you want to be a writer, that means you want to be able to go around telling people you're a writer, but you may not actually want to write, you know.
Right.
It's like the difference between I want to be a champion and I want to play baseball or something. So right. How do you see that? I mean, that had a profound impact on me. What it told me was that it's work, just like anything else. It's work, and that your focus needs to be on doing a quality thing rather than on the rewards. How do you see that?
I would agree. You know, I sometimes get asked to, you know, speak to groups about writing and the writing process and things like that. And what I always tell people is, you know, if you want to write, you need to write.
Yeah.
You know, you need to sit down and you need to do it.
Mm-hmm.
People say, well, I've always wanted to write a novel. Well, then write a novel. That you just have to make that decision in your head to do it.
Right.
And then you have to do it. And it is work. There are plenty of days when I don't feel like writing anything. But, you know, I'm writing a weird Western story right now. It's due in 2 days. And, you know, I wasted time and did other things. And now I've got like 3,000 words left to do. It shouldn't take me long. But now I'm feeling that, you know, that pressure. You know,
right.
I need to go and get it done. And, I think a lot of people want to be writers just to have this imaginary cachet, I guess, in their head of being able to say, I'm a writer, and they think there's a certain amount of respect that will come with that. And, and some people foolishly think money as well.
That's funny, isn't it?
Yeah. But I think, you know, if you're going to write, you need to write because there's something inside you that compels you to do it.
Mm-hmm.
There have been many times in my life, sometimes once a week, it seems like, when I wish I could stop. I write every day. And like you mentioned, you hadn't done any serious, you know, prose fiction writing really since January.
Right.
I can't fathom that. I have to write. If I go too long without writing, I literally can feel it in my fingers.
Yes.
This nervous energy.
Understand. I'm suffering. I am. It's not.
Yeah.
I'm not just throwing that out like, oh, I haven't done it since January. No,
right,
I'm in physical pain from it. So I know exactly what you mean. Yes.
Yeah. And I think, you know, if you have that inside you, then write. Whether or not anybody ever publishes it or whether or not anybody ever reads it, I think should be secondary to you getting out whatever is inside you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I tell people, you know, I think fear stops so many would-be writers. They're afraid they're going to write something that's embarrassingly bad.
Yeah.
And what I always tell people is, if you write a bad novel, so what?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're not the first. You're not going to be the last.
Nope.
And even if you write a terrible novel, you're still, to me, much higher held in regard than all those people who sit around saying, I wish I could write one.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and writing, even writing something bad. I mean, this is the little sort of metaphorical thing that I've heard, and it's absolutely absurd and ridiculous. And yet at the end of the process, it kind of has validity to it.
Mm.
And that is when they say that everybody's got, you know, like 100,000 bad writing words in them.
Yeah.
And you just have to get those out. And obviously that's utterly ridiculous, but what it means is you have to do that much writing before you really start knowing what you're doing.
Yeah.
And so just work until you get to that point, and it comes, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I you know, obviously everybody feels differently about every single work out there, but I think even my worst writing today is better than, you know, the best stuff that I was doing 5 years ago. Now, sometimes readers don't agree. And you know, I've told people before, I said, even if you write that awful novel and you put it out there, I said, I guarantee you, somebody is going to love it.
Yeah.
Because everything ever created is somebody's favorite.
That's
no matter
point.
How terrible it is. I've had people come up and tell me, you know, I loved this character or this story. And in my head the whole time, I'm thinking, man, that thing was I mean, I'm embarrassed by it. Yeah. Of course, I don't say that to them. I just say, thank you very much.
Right.
You know, I really appreciate that. But and sometimes the opposite is true. I've written things. I'm like, man, this is freaking brilliant. You know, and then it goes out there and nobody ever says anything, you know,
well,
you never know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Here's one thing that I've encountered. I, from an early age, see the things that I, it seems like the things that I paid the most attention to when I was reading and sort of absorbing from my own arsenal, were the flourishes, the little neat things, the things that stand out. And so what I discovered, I guess, in my teens when I really tried to write seriously the first time was that I had kind of figured out how to do the little cutesy things, the little effects, the special effects of a story. But I was not yet competent at at some of the basic things. Now, I'm a firm believer that for that 99% of writers need to be competent at the basic things. And I think a lot of people that want to write, they know that they're not totally competent. They don't have full confidence in their basic skill set, and that's going to hold them back because, you know, again, I can say I want to build a really nice house. Well, if I'm not really sure how to mix cement, I'm stuck on square one. You know, I can envision the house. I sure would like to build that house, but if I'm not confident knowing how to put, you know, put the cement together, knowing how to use make a complete sentence or something, knowing how to, you know, string sentences together, then that's going to hold me back. So I think that you learn those things by doing, and that's the idea about you write those bad words out is that you eventually, as you're writing, you start seeing, and if you go back and read yourself critically, you start seeing the things that are your weaknesses, and you can start focusing on learning how to do them properly.
Yeah, and I think people, you know, obviously not just writing is important, but you need to read other people's work.
Yes.
And sometimes you need to look at it. And what I always tell people is, you know, find your favorite author and go back and look through some of the passages that you really like, some of the pages, the scenes, and read it again and stop and think, how did they do that?
Yes, yes.
What are they doing that resonates with me?
Mm-hmm.
And obviously you don't want to just, you know, lift it wholeheartedly, but see if you can figure out the process that they went through, how they described those things. You know, did they go real in depth, you know, onto the character's thoughts, you know, or were they able somehow to do that in a manner that wasn't incredibly obvious, you know, and really just read critically and try and adopt those things into your own writing. You know, there have been times when, you know, before I wrote Rabbit Heart, I spent just a couple of months reading nothing but the most hardcore horror fiction I could find. everything that was so – because I had been writing before that so much classic pulp adventure. And I had read a lot of horror in my life, but I never read it critically.
Right.
I knew the feeling that those kind of works could create in me, and I wanted to create it in other people. And so I went back and I read some things that I had loved previously, and I read some things for the first time that were by authors that I like. And I really tried to see how they push those buttons.
Yes.
And
yeah.
I tried to learn from that.
Yeah. And, you know, and I always tell people, if you want to write, don't just read the exact same thing and try to write more of that. You need to go outside your comfort zone. Now, I had, you know, English teachers in 7th, 8th, 9th grade always telling me, or 6th, 5th, whatever, telling me, don't just read science fiction, read other stuff. And I didn't really want to then. But I was in the process back then of laying down the theoretical foundations of the type of stuff I like. As I got a little older, I've gotten into reading like Napoleonic War, historical fiction, you know, all kinds of stuff. Stephen King that I never liked before just because he's such a good craftsman, whether you like, you know, sentient evil cars or dogs or whatever. He's just such a good craftsman and, you know, things like that. And so, you know, I always say, you know, what, like they say, if you wanted to write a Star Wars novel, don't just read Star Wars novels because you're not going to do anything original. If you want to write a Star Wars novel, read Horatio Hornblower, read Master and Commander, read something that's not related but kind of could be, because then you'll come up with something original to say that nobody else maybe has said to some degree, you know. Would you? How do you see that?
I mean, yeah, I think you're exactly right. I mean, you know, one of my all-time favorite authors is Frank Herbert, who wrote the Dune series. Mm-hmm. And I think you would be hard-pressed to find an author whose style is less like mine.
Yeah.
and yet, every time I read one of his works, I am inspired to go and do something of my own. And I couldn't even tell you exactly what I'm taking from his work. Mm-hmm. But I'm obviously taking something because it inspires me. I love, you know, the way he would do characterization at, alongside these huge, you know, overarching plots, which again is not much like my work, but you know, I enjoy reading it. And I definitely don't think you would ever improve in whatever your genre is if you read only that genre.
Right.
Because eventually you're going to start repeating so many tropes and everything's going to start to sound the same. And, you know, you have to incorporate elements from other things. And sometimes, yeah, I mean, I'll read nonfiction and I'll read, you know, historical fiction. My wife is really into this vampire romance series. And so she convinced me to read the first one and this kind of stuff. And
right.
And even if it's not really my thing, I can still read it and go, well, you know what? That paragraph is pretty good. You know, let me see what he was doing there or what they were trying to get accomplished there. And you know, sometimes I've taken on projects that were, for instance, Weird West is not something I'm into. But, you know, this thing I'm working on now is going to be the third Weird West short story I've written.
Mm-hmm.
And it's good to sometimes force yourself out of your comfort zone to do something different. And sometimes, you know, you stumble into something you didn't know you were going to like. Thunder Jim Wade, I was completely unfamiliar with when I took on that project. I love those stories. Hell, I think they're better than the Doc Savage things they were riffing off of. and I really enjoyed writing that character. And sometimes you discover, you know, wow, I'm never writing anything like this again. It was just so terrible, the experience. And you know, earlier when I was mentioning about fan fiction, about writing to an audience, I found that kind of tie that back into this. You know, sometimes, you know, people will say you should write for yourself, and I agree with that. But, you know, if it's a job, if you're being paid to write something that even you're not necessarily into, you owe it to the fans of that character to sell it.
Yeah.
So, you know, I wrote a G8 and his Battle Aces story for Moonstone. I hate Aviator pulps. I don't enjoy them.
Mm-hmm.
But I know there's people who love G8. And so I read a bunch of G8 novels and I read some other stuff about aviation of that period. So that when I wrote that story, if I did it well, then the people who love that character, when they read it, they'll think that I loved that character too.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I'm trying to sell that because I'm not writing that one for me. I'm writing it for fans who love G8.
Right.
And, you know, sometimes you've got to stretch yourself in what you read and what you write if you want to improve. And I think even that experience writing G8, there are things about that process that I think later infused some of my Lazarus Gray stories.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if I had read nothing but Avenger style pulps, you know, when I'm writing Lazarus Gray, I think it would be much more of a pastiche than it is.
Right.
You know, now it's obviously just something that was inspired by that, but it's completely its own thing.
Right.
So, I mean, I agree with you 100%. I mean, you've got to vary your net when you're casting it out there in order to find new things.
And that's going to segue us over real well to talking in our last segment here about some of your stuff. But I wanted to mention, the idea of going outside your comfort zone. You mentioned a couple of examples. Yeah, when I did, you know, I've done more stuff in the 1930s setting than I ever dreamed I would, because it wasn't really a setting I was that interested in, the Indiana Jones type setting, you know. But I had to do a lot of research when I did my first Griffin story, and learning about the airplanes of the 30s and everything, whatever, I didn't know all the details and everything, because those kind of stories demand lots of details, right? The readers want to know what kind of mufflers are on the plane, what's the caliber of the machine guns yes. and the wings and all that, and I had no clue. And so it's like you said, when I did all that research, I found it kind of interesting, and I started learning all kind of neat stuff, and I'm a little more comfortable riding in the 30s now. So that is a neat thing, is you might actually discover, if you go outside your comfort zone, you might find a new comfort zone and you didn't even know it was there. So
yeah, it's kind of funny. I mean, I spend so much time riding in the 30s and reading stuff, you know, for ideas to put into that period, that when I do write something modern day now, it feels so foreign and scary to me.
Yeah.
Which you would think modern day, I mean, I'm in the modern day. I shouldn't have to research this,
yeah.
you know, but when I take on a modern day project now, I'm like, oh, I don't know. What am I going to do? You know,
what were people like in that period? Oh, wait.
Yeah, exactly. You know, oh my God, do these people have cell phones? What are they going to do with a cell phone? You know,
exactly.
Because I have so much, you know, I have such a base in the 30s and that technology mm-hmm. and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, all right. Let's say that you're at a convention and you're there with your table full of books, and somebody walks up and sees the Rook and says, "What is this all about?" What would you say to them?
I tell them that the Rook is a vigilante based out of Atlanta in the 1930s and 40s, and that he witnessed his father being gunned down by criminals, and that shortly thereafter he began to experience painful headaches that, you know, warned him of crimes that were about to be committed. And if he doesn't act on it, if he doesn't do something about it, the pain gets worse and worse. And so he's really compelled to go out and become a hero. And I tell them that, you know, in the very first book, we find out the origin of these headaches, and they actually come from his father from beyond the grave. And so his father is actually using his son as an instrument of vengeance against the kinds of people who killed him.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I usually tell them, you know, it's kind of an Indiana Jones slash, you know, Batman slash Shadow kind of thing, mm-hmm. Depending on, you know, what their knowledge of pop culture is, and kind of go from there. You know, if they're familiar with the old pulps, I tell them that it's inspired by those, but it's a lot different. It's a little more mature, and the characters do age over time. They do change. You know, the Rook gets married and has kids and things like that. And I usually do it that way.
And there's like you've developed like a whole history related to this character, right, throughout the years.
Yeah, I have a timeline. Most of my pulp adventure stuff is set in the same universe. So Lazarus Gray is in the same universe as the Rook, which is the same universe as Gravedigger, which is actually the same universe as Guan Yin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all of these characters exist in the same universe. And so I have this massive timeline that runs in every one of my books now that kind of, you know, tells you when things are happening and where people are. And it started as just an aid for me to keep it all straight. And then I was like, you know, this is probably going to be confusing as hell to readers as well. And so I put it all out there.
But that kind of thing is really fun for readers, though. Readers like to have like the little yes. guide with the long chronology and all that. That's a fun thing.
Oh, yeah. People comment on it all the time. And there was one book, I forget which one it was, a couple of years ago, came out and the publisher forgot to include it. And I heard from at least a dozen people, you know, where's the timeline, you know? And, yeah, they really missed it.
What kind of enemies does the Rook face? What are we talking about? Give us some examples and sort of some comparisons.
Well, the Rook, most of my characters exist in a world where there's a lot of supernatural elements.
Hmm.
You know, one thing that I always hated about a lot of the old pulps, or not hated, but, you know, it disappointed me,
mm-hmm.
was you would have Doc Savage going up to face apparently a werewolf. You know, they would call it the brand of the werewolf. There'd be a werewolf on the cover. There'd be people seemingly being killed by werewolves. And then you'd find out it was a guy wearing a suit. You know, it's the Scooby-Doo thing, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mr. McGregor with some lights and stuff. And that always disappointed me. And so when I started to write The Rook, I said, you know what? I'm going to have The Rook go out there and face somebody who looks like a werewolf and who is killing people like a werewolf. And there's going to be a werewolf on the cover. And damn it, it's a werewolf. So he faces a lot of supernatural enemies. One of his big enemies is the warlike Manchu, who's basically Fu Manchu, although I can't call him that.
Right.
You know, he's kind of an immortal character who's, you know, popped up throughout history, and he squares off with the Rook in at least one story in each of the first five volumes. But, you know, he also squares off against Rasputin. He faces a lot of elder gods, things, you know, swiped directly from H.P. Lovecraft, you know, a lot of secret societies, that kind of thing. The Rook, you know, has probably saved our dimension from being invaded by demons, you know, too many times to count, that kind of stuff. So, yeah, it's very much a supernatural flavored universe. And the Rook is really at the forefront of that.
Well, you have a couple of other, at least, right, major characters now. Who? Let's see. Before Lazarus Gray, he's next, right?
Yes.
Okay. Tell us about Lazarus Gray.
Lazarus Gray originally came about because Tommy Hancock came to me and said he was going to start something called the Sovereign City Project, and he was inviting myself and Derek Ferguson to create heroes for it. And basically, it would be this city, fictional Sovereign City. And all of our heroes would interact in the same city. And so separately, we all started to work on our characters. And kind of separately, we kind of ended up choosing kind of archetypal characters, because Tommy ended up doing Doc Day, which is very much a Doc Savage kind of thing. Derek came up with Fortune McCall, which in terms of having agents and everything like that is fairly Shadow-esque. And I came up with Lazarus Gray and Assistance Unlimited, which is kind of a riff on The Avenger and Justice Incorporated. Mm. And basically what happens with Lazarus Gray is he washes up on the shore of Sovereign City with no memory of who he is or how he got there. The only clue to his identity is that he's holding in his hand a golden medallion that has the words Lazarus Gray carved into it. Well, within a few minutes, somebody shows up trying to kill him, and our hero quickly finds out that not only does he know how to defend himself, he's quite capable. He's a great marksman. He knows all kinds of fighting styles. Whoever he was before he lost his memory was a very dangerous person.
He's sort of a pulp Jason Bourne in a way.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
There you go.
And so he decides to set up shop in Sovereign City. And this being the 1930s in a pulp world, he decides he's going to help people who need help because he has all these skills. And he forms Assistance Unlimited, which is made up of other people who he's helped out of dark situations and who then decide they want to work with him to help other people. Mm-hmm. And he decides to call himself Lazarus Gray in the theory that this will draw out anybody who might know what that medallion means or who he might have been before.
Very good.
Yeah, and it does do that. It draws out a lot of people who want to kill it. And the very first book is actually a collection of seven short stories. And then books two and three, three is about to be released.
Okay.
They both have two stories each, so it's two novellas in each one. And I've already written volume four, which is, again, two novellas. And I've actually started work on volume five.
Oh.
So probably the one I'm working on now won't see print until about 2015.
Wow.
So I'm way ahead of the game. But books two through four, even though there's going to be a total of six stories in those three books, each one has an undercurrent that's kind of running through it. And so if you've read book two, you think you got two complete stories. But when you read book three, you're going to see some bleed over into that. And book three actually does end on a little bit of a cliffhanger. And once you get to four, you realize that two, three, four actually are going to form one huge story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's definitely the biggest story that I've ever done. It's nothing compared to the stuff you or Wayne Reinagle does in terms of plotting. But, you know, I for me, normally I plot in my head. But this one was actually so detailed, I had to create a Word file called The Big Reveal that had about three paragraphs in it of things I had to make sure I did over the course of these three books so that the reveal at the end of the fourth one would make any sense. You know?
Right, right, yeah.
And so that's Lazarus Gray. He was inspired by my love of The Avenger, but like with The Rook, it's a very supernatural flavor. You know, the Illuminati is one of his big enemies.
Hmm.
You know, and then there's resurrected Egyptian princess named Femi that shows up with mummies a lot. And unlike with the Rook is kind of classic pulp in that most of his enemies tend to die at the end of the story. So he has a lot of one-off enemies. But Lazarus Gray was designed to be more of a continuing series, and so sometimes his villains get away or return somehow. So it's much more of a serial kind of storyline.
Well,
go ahead.
Well, tell you this. So it's part of the Sovereign City. Are those just coming out as sort of separate books from those three, from you and the other two, or is there some kind of unified publishing thing behind it? Or how, in other words, how would the readers and the people out here, or the customers, know, oh, this is all part of one thing, and is there some other thing that gives you more information or background on that world?
They're labeled on each book. There's a little Sovereign City Project label on it and a little icon.
Okay.
So people can recognize it that way. And they all have similar titles. You know, it's The Adventures of Lazarus Gray, The Adventures of Fortune McCall. Doc Day has only appeared in shorts so far. But once that book comes out, it'll be, you know, The Adventures of Doc Day. Okay. So we're trying to kind of tie it together that way. You know, if my character's like Lazarus Gray, he's kind of got a foot in both worlds because he's part of the Sovereign City Project, but he's also part of my ongoing universe. You know, hopefully it would never come to it. But I mean, if for some reason Sovereign City were to go away, if Derek and Tommy said they're not going to do it anymore and they're not going to label these things anymore, you know, it wouldn't require a whole lot for me to divest my series of the elements that were unique to that. And just kind of take it with me.
Sure.
And obviously I don't want that to ever happen, but I've been a part of enough things that fell apart, to know that every time I enter into any kind of joint deal, I always kind of protect my characters.
Sure. No, you absolutely have to.
At some point. But yeah, that's how Sovereign City plays. Okay. They're all separate but kind of interconnected. And so for instance, Derek came up with the character of the mayor of Sovereign City. And in volume 4 and in volume 5 of Lazarus Gray, the mayor is actually a major character. Mm-hmm. But that was a character that Derek came up with. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we name drop each other's characters. And I think Derek is working on a short story where Fortune McCall's aides will team up with the folks who work with Lazarus Gray. So it's going to be like all the aides and worker bees kind of teaming up without the big guys with them.
That's pretty cool.
I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, that is pretty cool. That sounds great. All that does. It sounds like Lazarus Gray is really clicking for you, and this is a character and a concept that really is working for you.
Well, yeah. You know, I have kind of a love-hate relationship with the Rook. and, you know, not to compare myself to Arthur Conan Doyle or my character to Sherlock Holmes, but I understand, you know, the problems he had with Holmes because, you know, the Rook was originally I intended to write a story with the Rook. And then I came up with another idea. So I did a second one. And then, you know, when I went to Wildcat Books, they wanted me to do a book. And so I did a book of them. And then people were like, where's the second one? So I did a second one. And very frequently I would say, okay, I'm done with the Rook now. And then, you know, people would want more and I would give in. And and before I knew it, you know, there's been 6 books plus an anthology written by other people. And now I'm, you know, I'm the Rook guy. And I was, unfortunately, because the Rook was not set up to be an ongoing series, you know, in the very first story, I reveal the truth about his father. I have him fight Satan. you know, all this kind of stuff. It's like, where do you go? And so I found it to be, in some ways, a very constraining concept because, I've already revealed where the Rook ends up in the 21st century. I mean, it's all there.
Right.
And so when I decided to do Lazarus Gray, I had been hungering for a while to do another series. And so with Lazarus, I sat down and deliberately thought of what is something I could do 10 or 11 books of.
Right.
And I set it up to be a continuing thing. And I gave him supporting characters where I felt that each one of them was interesting enough to me that if somebody said to me, I want you to write a Morgan Watts or a Samantha Grace novel, I could do it and I would be fine.
Mm-hmm.
And so I created this whole scenario that I felt could be ongoing. And that's why I think Lazarus has clicked so well for me, because I set it up deliberately to appeal to me forever. And there's so many stories still to tell with those characters. And I think that experience helped me create Gravedigger, which I think is an even stronger core concept. And, you know, that one's built to go on and on as well.
And that's my last question in this segment before we get to the wrap up is tell us a little bit about Gravedigger.
Gravedigger is also in Sovereign City. And basically, her name is Charity Grace. And you heard me mention Samantha Grace earlier. There's a thread that runs through my entire universe. Some people refer to it as the Rook universe because he's the most popular character. But really, you could call it the Grace universe because there is a Grace character in everything. There's somebody with that name. They're all part of the same family. And Prose did a collection last year called The Family Grace, An Extraordinary History. That's just a collection of a bunch of stories featuring some of these Grace characters. Mm-hmm. And of course, Eobard Grace from actually the first pulp novel I did, which was, Conquerors of Shadow. And so Charity Grace is part of this family, and she is in Sovereign City, and she has lived a very rough life. And so she is a young woman who has turned to petty crime. And one night she breaks into the wrong house. And the owner of that house is there, and he shoots her and kills her. And she comes to in her own grave, and there is a mysterious voice inside her head who offers her a chance at life again, to resurrect her. Mm-hmm. And this voice says that it will give her 3 years if she agrees to be its servant on earth and to strike down those who prey upon the wicked and the innocent. That it will, you know, at the end of 3 years, judge her and see if basically her ledger is now clean. If she has been able to find redemption within those 3 years, it will free her from her obligations to serve it, and it will allow her to live a new life. If at the end of 3 years she's found to be still wanting, if she still has more sin on her soul than good deeds, then she's going to be cast down into eternal damnation. And so Charity, of course, decides to take the deal. And she discovers that throughout history, there have been other people who have had this deal offered to them, and they were called grave diggers. And she is the first grave digger. And as, you know, as she asks the voice, she says, you know, how am I going to, you know, purify my soul by killing people? And the voice tells her, well, you know, you're not killing them. They've killed themselves through their own actions and their own deeds. They've dug their own graves. All you're doing is shoveling the dirt on top. And so she becomes the first female grave digger. And it's very much, I think people read it and they would never realize necessarily that it's an homage to The Shadow, because it's very different. But unlike Lazarus Gray, who has friends that he works with, Gravedigger has agents. She cares about them, but ultimately they're tools, they're means to an end for her. She's got 3 years, and so she doesn't have time to waste around. You know, she's got 3 years. She's going to be judged on Halloween night, 1939. And the first book is, you know, really like in the first 3 months of her resurrection in 37. And you know, she's got these agents and she sends them out, and each one of them has skills that are specific and she uses them in specific ways. So that's designed to be a little different from the Lazarus Gray series. And, you know, in the first book, she encounters somebody who's trying to use the Necronomicon to gain power for themselves. And then she encounters an evil that actually dates back to Sovereign City's founding and, and has to take care of that. I think Gravedigger is a great concept. It has a tremendous character design come up with by George Sellis, who is an artist that I've been working with very closely the past few years, and has just an amazing cover. I think that cover has sold quite a few copies of that book, and deservedly so. And Will Mignot, who is a tremendous artist, I fell in love with his stuff back on DN Agents back in the 80s. He contributed some interior illustrations to that one, and it's just a damn fine looking book, even before you get into the story. And I think the story's pretty good too. I mean, I say that as the writer, you know, but, you know, I think people enjoy it.
Yeah, no, and I think there's no question about the way that it looks and all that. I mean, that's just a spectacular package, and that never hurts, you know.
Exactly.
So, I don't think there's any doubt. I mean, you show a continual ability to create really cool characters and with interesting situations built into them, and that's really fascinating, and it's why you've continued to be more and more popular, I think, in terms of your work over the last few years. There's no question. Let me ask you this real quick, just short answer. Which of those three do you think is your favorite if you only could do one in the future?
Now, Van, you've only talked to me for about an hour here. Do you really think I'm going to give you a short answer? No, of those three, I would probably lean towards Lazarus Gray as my favorite.
Okay.
But I think Gravedigger, especially as I do more books, would have a chance of maybe passing it.
Right.
You know, Gravedigger is the newest, so, you know, she has that new car smell still. You know, whereas the Rook, for me, is kind of lived in.
That new grave smell.
Exactly. Yeah, that fresh earth.
Oh,
yeah.
Lord, yes.
But, right now I would say probably Lazarus Gray, followed by Gravedigger. And,
okay.
And then, you know, the Rook kind of down at the bottom. But I love Max Davies, and I love the characters, and I appreciate that other people really love them.
Yeah.
And never say never. I mean, I've said it before. I'm not going to write any more Rook, and then I proved myself a liar. So I'm sure I will do more Rook stuff.
Sure. Yeah, I don't doubt that you will. Okay, well, is there anything else as we kind of wrap up here? We could keep talking about this all day if we could, but as our time kind of runs out, is there anything else that you want to get out there to the audience, maybe people that haven't read your stuff before that they might like to know about or might be intrigued about before we're done?
Well, I would just say, you know, if you're not a pulp adventure fan, mm-hmm. You know, you might be interested in Rabbit Heart, which is a kind of slasher horror thing. It's very different from a lot of my other stuff, but there are people who love that one who are obviously uninterested in everything else I've written. I've gotten more requests for a sequel to that one than anything else I've ever written.
Hmm.
And there's a new edition coming out from Prose in a couple of months, and it's got a gorgeous Jason Levescu cover. So try that one. And also The Damned Thing,
mm-hmm.
Which is my homage to the Maltese Falcon. And you know, if you read, it's basically like if you've read The Maltese Falcon or even seen the movie, you know there's this whole legend about the Maltese Falcon, this kind of quasi-mystical thing. And, of course, and no spoilers here. I mean, the book's, you know, like 100 years old.
Yeah.
But in the end, of course, you know, it's all just a MacGuffin. It's all just a lie. Mm. But I, you know, again, my dislike of the Scooby-Doo thing, I decided, well, what if there was an object out there that everybody was trying to pursue, and it actually was a damned thing? And
that's great.
That's what it is. That's and cool. And it's set in Atlanta in 1938 and 39. And I think it's very, very good, if I do say so myself. So if you're interested in just something different that are one-off things from me, I would recommend one of those two. And then if you like it, you know, try one of my series. I know sometimes it's daunting if you know, there's six books already in a series like The Rook, but pick up The Damned Thing. It's just one book.
Yeah, and I always tell people when they say, oh, you've got like seven Sentinels novels, I'm like, well, I started reading Avengers with 162. So,
yes.
You know, just jump on in. The water's fine. You'll be fine. You can catch up later. You know. So, yeah, absolutely. Sure. All right.
I always recap in every one of my books anyway. I always treat it as if it's your first book.
Right. Right.
So.
There you go. There you go. All right. Well, Barry, thanks a bunch for coming on today. This has been a really cool episode, and it's always good to talk to you in any context. But hopefully, you'll reach some new potential readers, and just keep on rising as you have been, and keep on keeping on.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It was a blast.
All right. Well, it's time for the rocket once again to get on out of here. Our time is up. And as always, we thank you for yours, and we will see you all down the road.
Listen, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at esonetwork.com.